Boom. All right. We have Jordan Feigenbaum. We asked Jordan if he has an octopus fact, and he doesn't. And I was going to give up, but Q is like, well, why don't we just have some type of octopus joke? And Q says he has one. So let's hear it real quick.
All right, fellas, how many tickles does it take to make an octopus laugh?
How many?
10 tickles.
Oh, wow. Okay. I honestly should have saw that one coming. Yeah. I feel bad about that. For the audience and myself. Yeah.
Nailed it. All right.
Nice.
All right. So on that note, Jordan, can you give a brief intro on all the things you're doing and who you
Oh
are?
boy. So my name is Jordan Feigenbaum. I started Barbell Medicine. Yeah, just over 10 years ago now. So in last month, November of 2022 marked 10 years. I am a physician. I also have a master's in clinical anatomy and physiology and a master's in business administration. Been a competitive powerlifter also for about 10 years. And as far as what I'm doing, really just trying to create a one-stop shop for high-quality information, evidence-based information for both health and fitness professionals, in addition to what I just call strength enthusiasts, strength geeks. That's that if you're into training, you're into exercise, hopefully some of our material is helpful. And by putting out that information, trying to make the community a better place and healthier spot. And yeah, that's what we're doing with Barbell Medicine. At least that's what we're trying to do. So you guys, the audience, you guys can comment and say if we're doing a good job or not.
Do you have any stats on the ratio of the listeners? Like how many are just kind of gen pop enthusiasts, clinicians, students? Do you know?
Yeah, so we did. We were trying to generate some data to get sponsors for the podcast. Not because it's like a money grab sort of thing, but rather I don't want to produce them anymore, is the thing. It's like I want to record them, send off the audio to an actual audio engineer that's a professional, make it sound really great, and just it's out of my hands, you know? So in order to do that and to fund that, all the sponsors would want to know who's your demographic, on average, how many downloads you're getting, this, that, and the other. And so, most of our listenership, it's split about 40, 30, 30. 40% are just training enthusiasts. They want to get stronger, they want to get more, you know, gain muscle mass, they want to get fitter, whatever. Another 30% are healthcare professionals. And so that's just everybody involved, you know, top to bottom, doctors, PTs, ATs, nurses, PAs, et cetera. And the other 30% are fitness professionals. So just, whether they're coaches, whether they identify as personal trainers, like whatever. So that's what they self-report. That's our demographic. And very dude heavy. We're about 75% dude. So we're working on expanding that. But at the same time, if you think about your average personal trainer or coach, it's a very dude heavy industry. So we're working on that, try to make it more appealing to women as well and inclusive. And but yeah, we're about 40, 30, 30 as far as the split across the board.
Got it. So it's been a little over 10 years. You had started it, was it right when you started med school or right before?
Yeah, it was right when I started. So 2012. I had been the director of education for a very large personal training company in St. Louis. That's where I'm from. And I'd been coaching people for at that point, I guess it was like 5 years, just out of my little gym. And when I started medical school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do through medical school. I had no th this is not the plan, but I noticed in some of those preclinical courses, every single course kind of mentioned exercise, dietary pattern change, et cetera. But it was more like lip service to it. It's kind of like, oh yeah, and by the way, you can alter these outcomes, or you should definitely encourage this to your patients. But it was never like how and what dosage and how would it actually improve the trajectory. And so I was like, I've been doing this for a long time, and I really do enjoy it personally. I was like, why isn't there more information available for clinicians? And then it's actually kind of by happenstance. We had to get involved in a quality improvement project with a long our longitudinal family practice sort of setting. So basically, you get assigned to a family medicine doc in the community, and you go there once a week on average and see patients with them your entire medical career. So 4 years, I basically was with the same group. And yeah, week two, they were like, pick a quality improvement project. What do you want to do? And you can work on this during your time here. And I was like, I wonder how many like patients get recommended exercise, just period, like at a primary care visit. And so then I kind of went into the literature first, just researched the problem. And so the stats are terrible. Less than 10%, for example, of primary care physicians even know that the current exercise guidelines exist. Of the 10%, less than half of them are actually recommending it to their patients. And there are multiple barriers, whether it's time, whether it's knowledge, whether it's comfort, whether it's personal experience, something like that. So I was like, this is my quality improvement project. Like, let's do this. And that kind of sparked the idea behind barbell medicine. I was like, if this is a fund of knowledge thing for medical professionals, let's just put the information out there, make it more visible. And then I started thinking, I was like, man, I'm learning all this stuff in med school. Like, I wish I would have known some of this as a trainer. That would have been super helpful, especially at the intersection between medicine and exercise. For example, 50% of the adult population in the United States has high blood pressure. And as a, you know, trainer or coach, I'd want to know, like, are there risks? If no, like, I could assuage some clients' fears about, you know, deadlifting heavy and having high blood pressure, for example. Is the Valsalva really dangerous? So it just became this sort of like pet project, passion project, if you will, just like, let's put out information and see what happens. And then it, yeah, kind of blew up from there, which is cool. I didn't plan on it. It's kind of the end of it. But it just started, it was just a project about a passion project for putting out information. And, people then started asking for coaching, and I mean, it started with just me in 2012. And then now there's, I don't know, almost 60 contractors, I guess, working for the company, which is terrifying. I'm like, man, what if something goes bad? What if we screw up? You know, but yeah, that's kind of been the growth trajectory for barbell medicine.
That's wild. I didn't know there were 60. I would have guessed like 20 or 30.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of on the back end, as far as, you know, digital marketing and website development, and app development, just, yeah. I look, every time payroll comes around, I'm like, why are there so many people here? But no, it's been fun.
You did your family medicine residency at UCLA. At before you even accepted or started that residency, did you know, oh, I don't think I'm going to be in clinical practice by the end of this?
Yeah, at that point, I was pretty sure of what I was going to try to do. I was pretty hardcore ortho throughout medical school, so I was like, I'm going to get the best grades as good as I can. I'm going to study as hard as I can, which, you know, I don't know that it would have been different had I been family med like from the beginning, but it's just, I knew that ortho was very competitive. And also our med school did not have an ortho program there. So I would have to be a standout to get accepted. So I was just like, let's full send on the academic side of things. And so I had an elective with a hand surgeon my third year. So this is right before you start sending in your applications for residency, you kind of pick where you want to go. And he basically kind of took on this mentorship role with me. And he said to me, he sent me down, he goes, to me, it's like you're at a crossroads. It's like, you are well qualified. You'll likely match into ortho and you'll be fine. Your whole life will be fine. Everything is set up for you. You do not have to create your own path. You just show up, put in the work, you'll make a bunch of money and you'll likely be satisfied with that on many levels. Or you could do this other path, which you'll likely have to create your own way, you know, carve out your own niche to provide this high quality information to people, to work with folks remotely, to educate other healthcare and fitness professionals. And you really do seem to love it, but I cannot guarantee that you'll be successful. What I can guarantee is that if you don't at least try, you're going to have regrets. And that's up to you to decide, with, you know, if you're okay with that potential loss. And I was like, Jesus Christ, what am I supposed to do now? So anyway, long story short, after wrestling with that for a few days, I was kind of like, yeah, I at least got to try. Cause the worst thing that happens in my mind, at least at the time, oh, I just have to be a regular doctor, which would have been fine. I don't actually think that I would have liked family practice just myself. It's like the day in, day out grind of seeing 20, 25 patients and not really spending enough time with them. So if I had to do family medicine, I would probably set it up in a way where I got to spend more time with patients to actually do all the things that we talk about, whether it's counseling on exercise, lifestyle change, in addition to all the medicine that can benefit folks. But yeah, I didn't really know until third year. And then after that, I was like, all right, I'm full send into this. I'm going to do this family medicine residency because I'll get exposure to everything And it's only 3 years compared to 5 years for ortho. And it was really hard to rationalize a 5-year residency if I wasn't going to operate. And also they don't want to train me if I'm not going to actually go in and do the procedures. Plus the last part was like, from a public health perspective, do we really need another ortho, like telling people to eat better? Like that's not, you know, that's not where you're going for your subject matter expert in dietary pattern changes, for example, or other lifestyle stuff. You're going to ortho for injury, for example, or surgical consultation. I'm like, yeah, so maybe a better skill set would be through family medicine. Internal medicine would have been fine too. I just really wanted the OBGYN and pediatric experience, which is, that was kind of the difference maker there. So Austin, for example, went internal med, and I did family med.
Got it. Yeah, I sat down with Austin when I was back in San Antonio my first year of school, and I asked him, like, why weren't you going to go down the route of ortho or something that's a little bit more like a lot of these orthopedic and MSK topics? And he was like, it just wasn't stimulated enough. Like, it wasn't hard enough.
Yeah. So yeah, I could see that. I mean, I had my anatomy background, like, but when I did that master's in clinical anatomy and phys, it was very like surgical procedure heavy, just in like trying to figure out like, why do they do this approach and what are the outcomes? And so I was geeked up on it. I mean, I loved the anatomy. I love the, you know, working with my hands, putting stuff together and whatever. And it seemed also very discreet and straightforward, like broken bone, messed up joint, messed up, you know, whatever, fix the thing better. And obviously at that point, I did not have a lot of exposure to not only the biopsychosocial model, but also the complexities of the pain experience and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So definitely limited scope. But in my mind, I was like, this is cool. So for me, definitely stimulating on some level, but not stimulating enough on all of the levels. If I was doing ortho, I could probably operate 1 or 2 days a week, maybe half days, and then otherwise be good if I could do other stuff on the side. But that's not really, it doesn't really work in the modern medical machine, you know, unless you're about to retire or I'm like, you're a professor and you operate 1 day a week, but you don't want that person to be your surgeon either. You want the person who's doing all of the procedures specific to what you need, because they're probably the best trained, you know. So anyway, long, that's how I ended up in family med. And I think family med's probably the hardest specialty, because it's so broad. Like, your knowledge base has to be so broad, and you have a lot of barriers to actually rendering care. It's not just like, yeah, take this med, make this lifestyle change, whatever. It's the behavioral change aspects of it, the social barriers that people have to making change. And then also, again, the very diverse things that you're managing. And it's like, oh yeah, by the way, you got to do that in 5 minutes. It's like, I don't know that that's realistic, but yeah, definitely not, don't want to suggest that any of the other medical specialties are not difficult. It's just, from my perspective, family med is very, very challenging.
Do you watch, do you know, is it Dr. Glockenflecken or whatever? The guy who makes his like a stereotype or archetype of the family med or PCP, where he's just like, you know, needs psychological counseling because of how chaotic the job is and how many just barriers there are to not burning out. Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was actually interviewing for family med, they were like, why family med? Like, your board scores are obviously very high. You did very well. You know, why did you choose? You're choosing to do family medicine. It's like, why? And I was like, well, I would tell them the skills. I wanted all these skill sets. And then the other part was like, if I can create some sort of business model that works better for family medicine, like potential trainees, where they would have higher earnings, for example, more job flexibility, a better work-life balance, if you will, that makes it more enticing. You know, if you think about, if the salary for a family med physician was the same as an orthopedic physician, maybe then you're starting to tempt some of the candidates to go into family medicine, just from that standpoint. But as it stands right now, if you're a non-traditional graduate, you're a little older, maybe you have a little more student loan debt, if you really want a high paying job, I mean, family med is not really your first choice. But if it was, like, if you had a very, you know, potential to use a different business model to create that type of lifestyle, yeah, I think that at that point you have a very competitive specialty. You're going to get the best and brightest. That would be beneficial, I think, for family medicine overall. the biggest issue, and he highlights this nicely in all of his jokes and whatnot, is that there's just so much to do and not enough time in the day to do it. And so, yeah, my hat's off to the current family medicine practitioners. You guys are doing the most. You're doing the Lord's work out in the community. It's just, yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah. So I'm very curious, from the first seminar that y'all gave till the most recent one in LA, can you just like contrast the general experience of, like, if someone was to go to the first seminar 10 years ago or whenever y'all's first one was? I'm sure it wasn't that long ago. When was it? It was
how far in? 17 was the first time we did a full like 2-day seminar. So it's been about 5 years. Man, that was in San Antonio, Texas. I remember right now we go from about 8 a.m. to about 6 p.m. on both days. So, you know, still long days, but those were 8 to 8. So longer. The lecture material was it was less polished because we wanted to present it like a medical conference or like a, you know, poster presentation, rather than like really hammering on the practical take home stuff in plain language. And we also had no feedback at that point. We're like, well, this makes sense to us, so we'll get some feedback from the attendees and then refine, which, you know, ultimately, you know, people who are paying the money, taking the time out of their busy schedules to come spend a weekend with us, they're going to tell you, oh man, I learned so much. You know, this was great. But when we started asking people questions like, hey, what did you think about this? It kind of showed that we were probably going too far into the weeds on stuff. Austin, for example, had a 90-minute testosterone lecture. And it's like, is discussing, you know, the effect of different hormone levels on training outcomes important? Yes, but we can probably wrap that up in 20, 25 minutes and hammer the take homes that, you know, the short-term changes in hormonal concentrations, you know, during and after exercise don't really play a role in training outcomes. And we probably don't need to worry about that. So that was one example of a difference. Or the cholesterol lecture was like, okay, here's what HDL is, LDL is, intermediate density lipoproteins, all this stuff, and really get into the weeds. And people are like, what do I do with this information? And it's like, yeah. So maybe we'll focus on how can we change cholesterol levels, lipoprotein levels with respect to different health outcomes, using a lifestyle approach, using medicines, and what can we expect? We put in a behavioral change lecture compared to really focusing on, like, you know, particular disease process. I mean, I had an hour type 2 diabetes lecture. I want to use that disease process to highlight potential effects of the current dietary pattern in a westernized society, but I don't need to drive home, you know, go into the weeds on like autoimmune type diabetes. You know, I can just talk about these concepts more generally and get the point home. So everything's evolved in a way to improve learner retention, and then also give people more practical take home information. And it seemed to work so far. People, again, they still enjoy it, but when we ask them questions at the end, they seem to retain a lot more. And this is really evidenced through the questions that we get in our Q&A. Rather than like clarifying stuff that we went over a bunch of times, they're more thoughtful and thought provoking, certainly. So yeah, if you came to a seminar in 2017, we appreciate it. Thank you. But the new seminar is significantly different, and we'd love to have you back. I would even say probably the biggest changes that we've made occurred from maybe like 2019 to 2020, because we had a break with the pandemic kind of shutting us down for a few months. So we really got to put in a bunch of work there. The next biggest change is going to be offering people certificates for completing the seminar. You came to the seminar, you took the test. Now you have a barbell medicine certification. And so that's going to require some testing to occur. But yeah, that's probably the next change. And we'll be doing that for both the pain and rehab seminar and then also our health and performance seminar.
And was there ever, Q, were you going to say something?
Yeah, you're good.
Oh,
you also, can we just say that Q has the best hair on this call? Like, he's got the most handsome hair that I'm very jealous.
I mean, it's not a easy, it's not a hard competition. I have no hair.
Yeah, so. right. And I have a hat, so
we're on the same part. I hear.
Yeah, you got great hair, buddy.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure I'd heard you talk about potentially a position kind of either course or certification. Is that true at some point in the future?
Yeah. The original idea was to have like a certificate program for healthcare professionals, and then a separate one for fitness professionals, and then a separate course for, again, the general exercise enthusiasts. The idea being that, all right, different audiences, different needs, goals of, you know, education, this, that, and the other. But I think, you know, the more we've interfaced with all these people, particularly at our seminars, it actually seems like an incoming level of knowledge is relatively similar. Because again, if you're coming to the barbell medicine seminar, like you already have some exposure to this. Nobody's showing up like, what's a barbell? Never lifted in my whole life, you know? Although we have had people who bring their parents who have not lifted, but they're generally curious. So that's probably the closest we get to that. So really what it's going to look like is more just a certificate program in general. And then after that, there'll be specialized courses, or a course material that people can take, and there'll be e-courses. I think is going to be the way to distribute that, disseminate it, most practically. But I think there's got to be some base level of, okay, you know, all of these things with respect to training, programming, pain management, nutrition, behavior change, et cetera. Cool. Now we can do some specialized stuff, whether you want to learn more on the programming end, whether you want to learn more on sports nutrition, whether you want to learn more on pain and rehab, like you can go down the rabbit hole further, but you have to have this sort of base level minimum knowledge that we could do through a entry level. I don't want to say entry level and people think, oh, this is just going to be easy stuff, but this sort of generalized certificate program, and then you can have more specialized certificates after that. I think that's the plan. I'm kind of modeling it after the Titleist Performance Institute, TPI. They have a cert for golf. And so they have like a level one, and then there's all these like specialized ones after that. I don't want people to take this and say, I love the TPI certification, because that is not the case. I went through it in my brain because I love golf. So I was like, oh, what am I going to learn here? And it's effectively like NASM meets golf. And it's like, oh, if you have an individual who is, you know, early extending in their golf swing, or has this sway on a takeaway, it's probably because they have a tight TFL or hip flexors. You got to stretch and mobilize and do this stuff. I'm like, are we sure? Like, we're sure about that? Like, is that the way we want to go? But I think the way they set up their courses, rather than the course material itself, is it makes sense to me. And you know, We'll find out if it works, and if not, we'll readjust. But that's kind of the way I'm thinking about it right now.
So, I've been trying to chip away at this, and I don't know if it's ever going to come out. This fibromyalgia piece for the website, and yeah, I initially sent it to Derek, and he's been using it's like some website that calculates the difficulty of a reading level for a piece or a certain writing, and it was like graduate level or college level, and he said his goal is to make it as digestible and readable as possible, and he tries to shoot for high school level. So it was extremely hard trying to figure out how to do that without being too vague and not using terminology that has to be used. And so I'm curious if y'all are reaching like 40%, 30-30, where it's kind of this umbrella of Gen Pop, clinicians, coaches. How do you know at what level to talk at?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it's kind of like the Einstein quote, right? Like, you should try to make something as simple as possible, but no simpler. And I think that's a paraphrase. I don't know that he actually said that. It's still a challenge for us, because you think about, if you're discussing medical conditions, you know, there are the nomenclature just in and of itself can be overwhelming, and it's like, you want to speak in plain language and make sure that people understand, but you also don't want to make up terms. You don't want to use words incorrectly. And you don't want to make analogies that are potentially harmful down the road. So for example, you look at people trying to liken the human body to a car or, you know, some other sort of inanimate object. And you're like, I get what you're trying to do with the analogy, but later on, you have to like backtrack that and say, all right, so we're not really like a car because we're a biologically adaptable organism. And that car is not. So forget all that other stuff. Let's like start over again. So yeah, it is challenging. I think the way that we address this is not only like interviewing people who have come to our seminar, getting like soliciting feedback, just to check for understanding, check for where areas that we can improve, but also, yeah, we use technology just like Derek suggested to you, as far as like how readable, if I just use this script, for example, or this, like how, what level is this at? And yeah, but it is very challenging communicating complex scientific topics in a way that is understandable, digestible, and accessible to a wide variety of folks, but also is not wrong. Because that's the other thing too. So it's hard to strike a balance, and it would be easier, I'm certain, if we just had a seminar for physicians, for example, and just a seminar for fitness professionals, and just a seminar for the general public. But that's not what we're doing. And the last thing I'll say on this is interesting. This has been like more personal experience. People will try to tell me about a particular, I read this study or saw this article on whatever, and it'll be something kind of hokey or a little woo, if you will. And they're like, I don't need to explain this to you. You're a doctor. You know how this works. And I, in my brain, I'm like, I have no idea how this works. Please explain it to me. You know, there's like kind of this assumption that if you're a physician, you already have a base level of knowledge and, you know, understand complex topics. But with respect to exercise and dietary pattern change, I do not think that is the case. And so I would actually say that for a good bulk of our material, the level that we're teaching to is probably the same, even for highly educated physicians versus, you know, people who are fresh out of college or, you know, otherwise not in the healthcare field at all. They're an engineer. They're, you know, they do something else on their day job. Cause doctors don't have this fund of knowledge with respect to exercise. They don't have this fund of knowledge with respect to dietary pattern interventions, even behavioral change. And so you're like, oh, maybe it's on some ways, maybe not as difficult. But yeah, when you're starting talking about medical conditions like high blood pressure and dyslipidemia and insulin resistance or whatever, yeah, at that point, the doctor's brains kick on and they're like, oh yeah, I remember all this stuff. Whereas the gen public was like, wait, you said what? And how does that work? And yeah, so definitely difficult striking a balance. And I do not envy your position trying to do that for fibromyalgia, not only because just the subject matter complexity, but also because there are a lot of preconceived notions about what the diagnosis means for the person and their trajectory. And it's like, so yeah, and you have to fight all that. And it's like, man, that's tough. So when you said that that was your initial article, I was like, oh boy, good luck.
Yeah, it's been, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. And I think Austin read it at this point, and then I think a few others have kind of gone through it and we've sifted it out. But yeah, the whole process of like, okay, is there actually a definition of fibromyalgia? And is it even like widely recognized across the board? And what is the clinical like criteria for diagnosing it? And is that even agreed upon? And then is there ways to actually treat it? Is it curable? And then all these like misconceived thoughts of like the trigger point and just trying to manage all of that. And then there's just no solid answers in the literature. The more I dove, trying to articulate the ambiguity without making the article by the time you finish it, it's almost nihilistic. Like I want to create a path. And if you've been given this diagnosis, what are the things that for sure are kind of a misconception, and what are the things that we can promote and say you're safely able to do? But it was hard to weave in like the ambiguity and understanding the uncertainty without making it feel like, oh, we know nothing, and this is making you feel helpless.
Yeah. It's kind of like I think people, when they get overwhelmed with ambiguity, which is, it's pretty common. People prefer concrete answers. People prefer black and white. It makes it easier to understand rather than having like a gray area, and being comfortable with being uncertain about things. I'm certain that our material would be wider read and wider disseminated if we kind of came down with concrete black and white, yes or no sort of things, but unfortunately, with respect to the human condition, most things have a pretty significant gray area, fibromyalgia included. But even as something as simple as like, I mean, even vitamin D levels, right? It's like vitamin D is super, super hot topic right now. We can't even get international and national health organizations to agree on, well, what is vitamin D deficiency? Like what level, what's the cutoff and why is the cutoff there? And like, if we agree on a cutoff, what should we do about it? And so, yeah, then people will say, oh, so the evidence isn't clear. The science isn't clear. Well, in that case, let's not use the science. Let's throw it all out. It's like this unicorn fallacy, because if it's not perfect, we can't use any of it. And it's like, well, just because it's not perfect doesn't mean we can't get obtain clues and tips and you know, some sort of insight here. It's just not as, again, black and white as people would prefer. That goes all the way to like even exercise selection. Well, what should I do? A 2-count pause squat or a pin squat? It's like, man, I can't go in the literature and give you sort of an evidence-based answer here that's black or white. They're both probably fine depending on your goals and how you respond and you know, your personal preferences. And then people are like, oh, this is all stupid. I'll just, you know, wing it. And it's like, I don't know that that's the best option either. So.
Yeah, I think, you know, to your point, there is a lot of folks, even in gen pop and among clinicians, where, and I won't name any specific individuals, but there are podcasts and other YouTube and Instagram accounts really put out a lot of, you know, fanciful sounding language, and they go into all of this minutia of science, and a lot of it is just some kind of concoction of verbiage that sounds really smart, but they are not really saying anything substantial. Yeah. And I, you know, I've heard sometimes when I've referred people to barbell medicine, and they're like, oh, well, they're not talking about, you know, this system and that system and this little endocrine that does this little thing and all this. They're talking about these, you know, really generalities, and they don't, you know, these guys are supposed to be doctors, and they, you know, and so they're almost expecting this lingo that is supposed to be talked so far over their head that then when it's broken down into these very simple subject matters of things that are within their practical control in their daily life and in their decision-making process, it's almost like it has an opposite effect. So I'm just kind of curious, you know, to hear you talk about maybe where you have found most of this struggle to be present, and then also how you feel you've been most successful in managing some of that perception from the people that you are trying to, you know, message to.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good question. You know, the idea is like, how do you put out useful information that people want to read, right? So you actually have like, are, you know, doing something in the space, but also that is helpful. I'm taken back to, I went to a sports nutrition seminar put on by Jose Antonio. He's, I think he might still be, I know at that time he was still like the editor in chief of the International Society of Sports Nutrition, ISSN journal. And he like went up there, and the first thing, he doesn't say a thing. He goes up to a whiteboard and he draws the Krebs cycle, listing all of the intermediates and like reactions or whatever. He's like, this is the Krebs cycle. You don't need to know this at all, but I wanted to demonstrate expertise and show you guys that I know what I'm talking about, but this is not useful to you guys. And that's kind of the way I think about a lot of what we're doing. It's like, yes, there are a lot of underlying pathways and mechanisms and, you know, these very complex sort of cascades that happen in the body. But when it comes down to brass tacks, like what do those things are relatively, not to get trapped in my own sentence structure, irrelevant. I cannot, you know, adjust these minutiae without making actual changes to your lifestyle or your behaviors. And so how do we make that happen to get those downstream effects to occur? And so the other part is, we really, from an epistemology standpoint, are sticklers about not relying on mechanistic data to make confident claims. And that, I think, is somewhat to our detriment, because, as you said, the podcasts and the YouTube, especially things that are very popular, accounts that are very popular, tend to rely on, oh, we found this one mechanistic study in rats or mice or in, you know, in vitro cell cultures. And so, yeah, we can make these recommendations for what happens in real life, even though there's an absence of evidence there. And we're like, that's great that it happens in a petri dish, or that it happens in mice, or happens in, you know, macaque monkeys, but I can't really say confidently this happens in day-to-day life. And in fact, the evidence that we have in humans is as follows. And so that's where we're at. And so people, that's, I think there's a lot of confusion created due to a sort of inconsistent epistemology amongst what I would call just scientific communicators. If we all agreed on the same epistemology, like you needed actual human outcomes to make a confident recommendation on lifestyle or behavioral change, then we'd all be saying approximately the same thing. We'd really only start to disagree at the margins and, you know, that bleeding edge. But with that sort of inconsistent epistemology where you're like, oh, a mechanism, that's good enough for me. Let's go. Let's make an hour podcast on it. And then, you know, get people to really focus on adding salt to their water or supplementing vitamin D or what, you know, whatever it is, that is not only enticing and attractive, it's also like a black and white sort of thing, right? Whereas our pieces on, you know, vitamin D supplementation are kind of like, well, it's probably, you know, the current evidence doesn't suggest a benefit to supplementing vitamin D unless you have these very specific medical conditions, or adding salt to your water on average would be bad for most people because it increases blood pressure and doesn't really seem to actually improve performance outcomes in athletes unless the duration of the event stretches over 2 hours or you're sweating a lot, in which case it's probably more related to food that's associated with the sodium and not the sodium itself, but that's a whole nother discussion. So yeah, anyway, I kind of rambled on there, but my big sort of pillars here are be consistent from an epistemology standpoint, require human outcomes. And then when you rely, try to convey those more heavily than mechanistic studies and, you know, these very interesting, albeit interesting, but irrelevant pathways. I don't need to talk about the Corey cycle to talk about anaerobic training. For example, the Corey cycle being when people recycle lactate to create glucose through the liver. You could have a whole podcast on that, but what is that? How do you transfer that to a practical recommendation for training anaerobic fitness? It's like, we don't need to talk about the Corey cycle. But if you went to an article and you're like, I'm going to learn about anaerobic exercise, and you previously saw some material with the Corey cycle, with lactate, with whatever, and then we don't really discuss it that much. They're like, these guys are idiots. These guys don't know what they're talking about. It's like, no, we're past that. We're, instead of boring you with stuff that you can't actively manage, we're going to go into detail on what is actually a practical approach to improving your anaerobic fitness. And that I would prefer, I think that's more useful, maybe less seductive or less attractive, but ultimately I think I'm pretty confident in the recommendations we've made. And again, our fund of knowledge, it just seems like we're maybe past some of that, what I would call entry-level mechanistic science. So I don't know. Hopefully that answered your question. I just feel like I kind of rambled there for a minute.
Yeah, no, I think that does. I think it's a challenge that most science communicators in this space struggle with, is that you're constantly fighting uphill against other science communicators, I guess is the term we'll continue to use, who sure. are using... you know, really, really what, maybe what, like you said, one specific mechanistic study that was done in seahorses to then extrapolate information as to what it is the human condition, you know, is, and what it is that so-and-so needs to be doing every single morning now, based on this. And those that I've done it with have experienced this much success, and you can buy my $19.99 program that sells this how-to guide, you know, and it just constantly is surrounding Instagram and YouTube, every ad that ever comes up. And, you know, I get sent these things all the time from people. And in fact, even today, and he listens to the podcast, so he might laugh at this, but someone was talking to me this morning about mouth taping.
Oh boy.
You know, and I know that you guys had kind of addressed that a little bit at the LA conference a little bit. It was one of the questions that came up, but you know, he used as an example that they taped the noses of chimpanzees and their faces just kind of like shriveled up and shrank. And, you know, potentially sure. But, you know, to me, it's like, well, that's not the argument. We're not saying that, you know, people should untape their noses as a, you know, potential medical treatment. You're saying tape the mouth. And so it's like a big leap and a hop, you know, to get to these, you know, quote unquote evidence. based approaches. And so I think I just wanted to hear from you how, you know, you felt that and then how you've managed it. And I think you kind of outlined that. And I think the next jumping point would be, and you do a great job of this, but, you know, you talk often on your podcast and in your conferences about how you've changed your mind on things, mm-hmm. things that you felt very strongly about that you no longer feel very strongly about. And maybe you could kind of articulate some of those things that you have previously felt strong about that you've now changed on, what that process has been like for you and what it takes to change your mind.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think a few things have happened. One, just, you know, doing this for 10 years, I think that has obviously coincided with my getting older, gaining more experience and more perspective. And I think earlier on, I was probably a little more overconfident in my positions compared to now. Some of that was due to maybe just less knowledge about statistics and how studies actually translate to the real world. I would see a few studies and I'd be like, feel pretty good about this. And then it's kind of like, I take a hard line. I'm like, well, the evidence suggests this and that's what it is. And now it's like, yeah, well, how good is that evidence? And how repeatable is that evidence? And is there, you know, what sort of challenges that position? And so that I think you, as you get older and as you again, read more and more and you have more experience, you tend to take a softer approach. At least that's been my experience. I think just, yeah, if I had read 1,000 studies at age 27 and now I've read 10,000 studies at 37, I'm like, okay, I have a better lay of the land and kind of how the uncertainty that you should probably have around many different positions. And so a number of things have changed. I think just recently on our most recent podcast, we talked about this concept of anabolic resistance. So anabolic resistance is due to a number of different underlying mechanisms. We think some of it's due to a reduced blood flow that happens in individuals who are older, not only to the gut, but also to the muscular tissue. And so the net result of this reduced blood flow is that, yeah, they did worse when it came to actually assimilating, accreting muscular protein. They basically absorb it less readily from the diet. It takes longer to get to the muscle. And once it gets to the muscle, the blood flow is compromised to an extent where they don't get this hyperaminoacidemia and that triggers muscle protein synthesis. And so my position was that we need to overload these anabolically resistant individuals with dietary protein and exercise. And you could use the existing evidence to support that. Unless you looked at the evidence that's been emerging, suggesting that people, if they just are active a little bit, effectively most of that anabolic resistance disappears or is attenuated to a level that makes it not a big deal. And so what that's done is kind of shift our protein recommendations a little bit lower. Before, I think they started out, they were closer to this 1.6 to 2.2 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day, which, you know, rounds out to be that 1 gram per pound. And now we're like, look, man, the average American needs 1 gram per pound, 1 gram per kilo body weight of protein per day. If we can get people up just a little bit, 1.1, 1.2, that's good enough based on the existing evidence outside of those who are trying to optimize muscle mass outcomes. But for your parents, for your grandparents, whatever, maybe just an extra half serving of protein is probably enough to really make a difference in their life. The bigger lever to pull at that point is going to be physical activity, which is really kind of the source of that underlying anabolic resistance as it is. Doesn't matter if they have a chronic medical condition, if they have a bunch of chronic medical conditions, yes, they might still be a little bit anabolically resistant, but if you get them active, that kind of just disappears. So that's one recent change that we've made. Other things that have been more gradual have been the sort of wide range of different programming options you can use to get people to get stronger and gain muscle mass. I think if you'd asked me in 2018, 2019, like, hey, what do I need to do to gain muscle mass and to get stronger? I'd be like, well, you probably need to do, a repetition scheme that is specific towards the task. So if it's max low velocity strength, low reps, you need to train somewhat close to failure, and you need to do enough sets, enough volume overall to sort of drive this response. again, continually emerging evidence has shown that you can use a wide variety of rep schemes, a wide variety of different intensities, a wide variety of different proximities to failure. And on average, people are still going to get about the same strength response. Yes, people respond individually and you have to tweak that based on their response, but it just gives us more options. And again, it's almost like introducing additional uncertainty into the recommendation, and people hate that. They're like, what do you mean I can do all these rep schemes or all these proximities to failure, all these average intensities and still get about the same response? Well, what do I choose? If I can choose anything, what do I choose? And it's like, yeah, that's kind of dealer's choice at this point. So there's been that. And then another big change has to do with probably the last one I'll mention has to do with the obesity epidemic. And I think I'd struggled for a long time trying to get some sort of central paradigm. Like, what is the central paradigm that I'm working with for obesity and obesity management? And so the way I'm thinking about it now is that obesity is a disease where people are maintaining energy equilibrium that sustains a higher than normal, higher than healthy body fat level. And so previously I probably would have said that obesity is a disease. I'm being charitable to myself that I would call it a disease. I don't know that I would have in 17 or 18, but let's just say that I did, where people consume too many calories for their metabolism and ultimately accumulate too much energy. And so it's a subtle change, but when you look at it through this current lens where people are in energy equilibrium to sustain a higher than normal, higher than healthy body fat, then the next question becomes why? You're like, well, why do they do that? And why do some people do that? And why do other people not? And at that point, you're led to an actual like targetable treatment area. And so the reason why many people, most people, in fact, with obesity consume that much energy to sustain those higher than normal, higher than healthy body fat levels has to do with their food environment. And the relationship that has on people's hunger and appetite hunger and satiety sort of feeling. So feelings of fullness. And because in our modern food environment, we have all these ultra processed foods that are very cheap, easily available, very energy dense and not that satiating, not that filling, people will tend to consume way too much energy that again sustains this higher than normal, higher than healthy body fat level. And so at that point, you're like, well, cool. So we just got to change the food environment. Yep. That is a necessary change we need to make. And if we can't do that, then we need to otherwise hack or fix or change this appetite satiety relationship, which is what all these modern weight loss drugs do. They all target the same area of the brain, the lateral hypothalamus, and basically increase people's satiety response to food, so that they're not relying on willpower, motivation, overcoming the odds to eat less. They're like, I just naturally am fuller sooner. And then that energy balance sort of gets back into check. So they lose and remove the excess energy stores that they previously had, that higher than normal, higher than healthy body fat. So it's been like subtle changes over time due to emerging evidence, particularly human outcomes. And I'm trying to think if there's an example of like a mechanism that I've discovered or come across where I've been like, wow, this changes everything. Maybe one. Okay. Here's maybe one. And for human strength performance, for example, force production, you can measure it however you want. It can be isokinetic, it can be isometric, it could be whatever you want. Non-contractile proteins in the human muscle tend to be responsible for somewhere on average between 60 to 80% of your force production, non-contractile. And so this has to do with proteins that attach the actual skeletal muscle fibers to the epimysium, connect it to other muscle fibers in separate fascicles, this, that, and the other. So these are non-contractile, but they ultimately help the contractile muscle filaments create force. And so what people would say on the internet is that, you just want to worry about what is it? Not sarcoplasmic hypertrophy, but the myofibrillar hypertrophy. We just need to get the contractile muscle fibers bigger. And it's like, nope, that'd be incomplete. That would be incomplete. And so that sort of changed my opinion on, okay, if you want to get somebody stronger, should they only work in the lower rep range? It's like, nope, we should work on all of them. Not only for all of the, constellation of adaptations you can get from resistance training, but also because want to develop non-contractile muscular muscle proteins because those are involved in force production, force transmission. So we got to do it all. But that was like maybe one mechanism where I was like, huh, interesting. I did not know that. So yeah, I don't know. You feel like an idiot when you look back at some stuff that you wrote and you're like, oh boy, why did I sound so confident? How was I so sure? And it's like, yeah, you just didn't know what you didn't know. And so now I think when I write stuff, I'm more cautious about where my blind spots are. And to your point earlier, that may be less attractive to some folks who are looking for the answer. And I'm like, well, I don't know that there is an answer here just yet, but we'll find it together. So that's what I can promise folks. But even if they don't like the information that I'm offering at this point, based on existing evidence.
To the point earlier about not utilizing or using it as the majority of the discussion for something with mechanistic research and data, you bring that up. It's interesting. My clinic has a spectrum of beliefs and ways things are practiced. It was started by two chiros. There's a chiropractic side, there's an orthopedic side, and then there's a physical therapy side. Some things we agree on, some things are very different. And so we started up a journal club, and one of the co-owners of the clinic, he brought me a paper, and he's like, is this okay if we have this for next Monday? And I haven't read it yet. And he was like, I want you to like clear it. And I said, even if it's a bad paper, I think it's a good talking point. So this was the paper that he's pretty stoked about. It's mechanisms and origins of spinal pain from molecules to anatomy with diagnostic clues and imaging findings. And it's this extremely extensive dive into all these potential mechanisms on discogenic pain, disc degeneration, herniations, neuropathic pain. And it's just like this very biomedical kind of perspective. And the week before that, I had sent out the Australia's like low back pain clinical care kind of guidelines. And so it's this interesting, I'm curious how the conversation will go, but it's a lot of the clinicians have this very like exciting view of these mechanisms or potential mechanisms. And then how do we pull it back to have a more like realistic, what does this actually mean? And can we even have any, like, from an epistemic standpoint, like you mentioned, are we even on the same page of how we're gathering this information and how we're utilizing it and how we're communicating it with patients? So I'm curious how the conversation is going to go, because it's one thing like on social media to bash this paper, but if you're surrounded by clinicians that all work in the same environment and also, you know, have co-treatments with patients, how do you manage disagreements and views and understandings of literature productively without just creating more polarity within an in-person setting?
Yeah. Yeah. I think with other professionals, especially if you're trying to have a discussion, maybe with differing viewpoints, the first part is establish what the viewpoint is, right? So if the thought on this particular paper is like, these molecules are not only significant predictors, but also significant modulators of low back pain in humans, such that modifying their levels via specialized treatment regimens improves outcomes compared to just ignoring them and doing the current standard of care that we practice here. So that's their claim. And you have them unpack that and clarify any sort of, like, what does this particular word mean in this setting, right? Is it always better? Is it significantly better? Is it just the same, not inferiority? Like, what do you mean? And so you get that sort of premise out of the way. And then at that point, you have to agree on epistemology. So for most of these questions, you would agree that, and most people who are scientists or at least involved in the scientific pursuit of knowledge would agree, yeah, you could answer these via empirical evidence, via data. And so if everybody's agreed thus far, you've agreed on the premise, you've agreed on how you're going to answer that premise or evaluate that premise, then you start just looking at the actual evidence, right? And so it would not surprise me. It actually would surprise me if there weren't any particular molecules that were identified in, you know, a serum sample that correlated with low back pain or were present in some amount of low back pain. The real question isn't like whether or not they exist. The question is, what do we do with that information? Does it change management? Does it change a sort of known trajectory reliably? And so if the answer to both of those based on existing evidence is no, then how does this impact patient care? Right. And if we have no evidence, it's like, oh, well, this is interesting. I'm going to file this away in my interesting folder until there is some sort of difference in either clinical management or counseling technique that would benefit the patient. Because otherwise you're just like, okay, interesting, but what do now? And if that's where you arrive after you've kind of gone through the existing evidence and you both agree that you can answer this question empirically, then you're like, interesting. I just don't know what to do with it. And maybe we do nothing with it, which is fine. It is fine to identify a mechanism that is interesting and also not doing anything with it. It doesn't mean you need to tell people about it. It doesn't mean you need to rationalize care with it. But that's my fear, is that people will learn of a mechanism, rationalize non-evidence-based sort of treatment approaches or interventions just because of a mechanism that has not bared that out in the research, particularly when it comes to communicating with folks, like either why they have back pain, how long they can expect to have back pain or any sort of pain experience, or why they're doing some other sort of behavior or intervention. Because I don't want to lie to people. And I am fearful that if I create a narrative that is not only incorrect, but also has the potential to cause harm, it's like, man, did I really benefit this person? And so, yeah, when I learn of a new mechanism that is interesting, but otherwise not really, doesn't really change my clinical practice or doesn't have evidence that shows that if I did change what I'm doing would actually benefit the patient, I'm kind of like, all right, file this away, interesting folder. I'll come back to this if new evidence emerges that does change what I do. So for example, if there's like a substance PYY that is through the roof with low back, you know, non-specific low back pain. And if you do this specific type of exercise, PYY levels go down. People have improved, you know, functional scores and report a shorter sort of duration of low back pain. Great. But if that doesn't exist, then I'm like, well, what do I care? You know, I would probably say it in a nicer way. It's like, I'm not sure what to make of this with respect to actual interventions or patient communication or whatever, which is fine. And I think if they had the same epistemology as you, you guys would both come to that same conclusion together. The real question would arise if they do think that it should change their management, whether it's communication, whether it's intervention, then you'd have to go to a second premise. Why? Why does it, you know, impact your care? And again, if you agree that this can be answered empirically based on evidence, what is your evidence for that? And you just, you know, not all of these conversations are fun, and people just time out and they're like, I don't have time for this. You know, like, I don't want to discuss this. And it's like, well, if we're really just trying to get to the bottom line of like, why do you believe what you believe and how does this inform your practice? Those are just difficult conversations to have. But I'm in agreement with you. Like, even if something is like, you look at it and at face value, you're like, this is dumb. Evaluate it still, because it just gives you a broader perspective. And going through this process also helps you understand where the other person's coming from. And I think you may not always come to a shared understanding at the end, but you know, at least you know why you disagree. You might get to the end of this whole thing and say, yeah, I disagree, because there's no real evidence showing that if I do anything differently, the patient's, you know, clinical trajectory changes. And they say, yeah, well, I don't care about that. And you're like, well, I guess we just disagree then. But yeah, that's kind of how I approach these things. If it's not, if you can't answer the or evaluate the premise or answer the question using empirical data, I don't know where to start. Cause that's not my field. If I'm a, you know, physician researcher, I can answer empirically answerable questions by using existing evidence. And if there's no evidence, then I'm kind of like, well, I don't really know how to figure out what the truth is, or the truth as we know it right now. And so I don't know that I have an opinion, which again is unsatisfying, but has the benefit of being true. It's like, if I can't use data, like, what do I do? You know, that happens a lot actually in coaching, because people will be like, why did you program it like this? Or why did you pick this exercise? And instead of saying, oh, well, the evidence is, I said, personal preference. I feel it's true, but I'm not confident. I feel it's true, but I'm not confident in it. And that's okay. That's okay too. But yeah. So hopefully that interacted with your question. I think it did, but
yeah, that was good. I'm curious, what topics has been the most controversial, has had the most pushback that y'all have discussed?
It's probably a tie between like low back pain, with respect to like tissue damage, like that being one topic, like, oh, well, why do people have low back pain if they didn't damage a disc, damage a facet joint, you know, compress a nerve, you know, something like that, versus the, like, who do you blame for the obesity epidemic? Because that both of them are very polarizing, but for different reasons. But the low back pain thing, it's more of a, again, being comfortable with uncertainty. It's like, well, if there's no damage, how can there possibly be pain? It's like, well, it's a more complex experience and just, you know, depends. There's a lot of nuanced sort of detail that goes into the pain experience. And it's just not simple as like, oh, here's one damaged structure, pain generator, fix that, you're good to go. Whereas the other one, people, it's almost like a moral kind of evaluation of a person. If somebody, if they're an individual with overweight or obesity, others will look at them and say, oh, they're lazy or dumb or, you know, whatever. And it's like, yeah, that's probably not the case on average. Rather, if you consider the modern food environment, if you consider, you know, all of the other factors that go into dietary pattern, and that most food choices and food related behaviors occur below the level of consciousness, you can't really hold the person or blame the person. It's not their fault for, you know, generating a condition where they are storing too much body fat. It doesn't mean that they're not responsible, though, for taking the actions that are available to them, the interventions that are available to them to sort of mitigate that or treat that. But rather, instead of blaming them on like, oh, you're just, you know, lazy, stupid, whatever. Again, it's sort of moral judgment versus like a lack of understanding with the low back pain thing. So both of those we get a ton of heat for. And I think people, again, just want it to be black and white, very simple, very straightforward, and also sort of like preserve their own ego. Right? If your understanding of low back pain is like pain generator, pain, fix the pain generator, no pain. And someone's like, yeah, that's not really exactly correct. They're like, whoa, 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 whoa. You're challenging my worldview. Don't like. Same thing with obesity. If somebody's, you know, says, well, it's just a lack of willpower, motivation, intelligence, et cetera. And you challenge that. They're like, well, no, this can't be. This can't be. You're saying that this person with excess adipose tissue is the same as me, you know, from an intelligence level, from a motivation standpoint, whatever. It's like, yeah, you guys are probably about the same. You just got a luckier hand. And yeah, through no sort of, you know, triumph of your own, you just happen to get here. And they're like, but no, I try hard. And it's like, I'm not saying you don't. I'm just saying they're trying just as hard as you, just got a different outcome. It's just like the people who are trained just as hard as I do or you do in the gym and don't get as strong. It's like, look, man, sometimes you get dealt a lucky hand, other times you don't. And it is what it is.
I think you could also get in the same moral argument way with the low back pain too, right? Where if you're describing it as all these other, you know, social, cognitive, like biopsychosocial inputs that you're seeing pain as this ecosystem, maybe then, you know, people are like, wait a second. So you're saying that like I'm mentally too soft and I'm too afraid of my pain. No, man, I'm not. Like I'm resilient. Like you say, I'm inside, like, no, there's something wrong with me. And that takes the responsibility a little bit and separates them from it. If there's like tissue insult and injury causing their pain, then they're no longer accountable and responsible for that thing. Whereas when you shift that conversation to be, no, pain has a lot of different contextual inputs. There's so much that plays into your pain. They almost take it personally that they're like personally responsible for why experiencing pain. And so you kind of have to maybe navigate that conversation as well around like, no, there's probably more that you're not in control of at all. It's the cards you were dealt, but it's still a result of all the incoming inputs that you have, you know, varying amounts of control over.
Yeah. People really identify with this underdog story. They're in control. They get to choose their own adventure. They get to, you know, really guide their own path here. And it's like, if I just try hard enough and if I'm just smart enough and if it's just whatever it is, it's on me, I will succeed. You see, I mean, it's all over social media, all this mindset stuff, all this, you know, just work harder, motivate, no one cares, you know, 24/7 grind, don't stop. Great. Look, whatever you need to do to fire yourself up to get through the workday, like I'm here for it. The point is though, it is not that simple. It is not that simple. And if that's your worldview, I'm going to challenge it and I'm going to challenge it empirically with data, and you can do whatever you want with that. But if we agree that, again, answering the, or evaluating the premises, evaluating claims can be answered via empirical data, you're going to have a tough time. And look, I wish it were as simple as just deciding. Just decide to eat less. Just decide to be fuller sooner. Just decide not to have low back pain. Just decide to do these particular exercises and that'll help you, you know, whatever. And it's like, yeah, I think that's just an incomplete story.
If you, I know this has been brought up a few times and I think you're the April Fools, but let's say you were on Joe Rogan.
Oh yeah.
I'm sure you've thought about, obviously it's like the biggest platform to discuss and have a platform. In an ideal situation, how could you see that being like a productive conversation, and what would you really want to address or be some primary kind of discussion points if you were given kind of an open platform to guide the conversation?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, most of the time his guests have some sort of controversial, like, claim, right? Like the one thing you don't know, or you're the one thing your doctor doesn't know, or whatever. It's like something like that. And I think we could really appeal to folks about, like, here's what your doctor doesn't know about exercise, and you know, here's how this can be beneficial, and like, here are like common myths around exercise. You could do that with respect to injury risk reduction or injury risk of exercise just in general, the potential benefit, especially in cases like migraines, high blood pressure, glucose management, where there's actually some evidence showing that exercise is actually better than pharmaceuticals. And sometimes if you use, some people of course need to use both, but you know, you could get into the weeds there. That would be interesting. And I actually think I probably would get a lot of positive feedback from Mr. Rogan there. He'd be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Oh yeah. And obviously it'd be beneficial for us getting our name out there and whatnot. I just think, like, because a lot of our positions are relatively, I wouldn't say soft, I would just say they're not concrete, right? They're like, yeah, you could do this, or you could do this, or anywhere in between, and that's all going to be fine, lead you to the same point, all roads lead to Rome. That's just less sexy. So that would be, you know, I think I would be needled or pressed to be like, no, make a decision. Is it this or that? It's like, yeah, it could be both. Why not both? Why, or when you can and, let's do both. Yeah, I don't know. I don't suspect he's going to have anybody on this podcast talking about like general exercise for health promotion in the community, but I would love to debate somebody like Robert Oberst. I would love to debate, you know, on his platform, or, you know, somebody else talking about a specific exercise regimen for health promotion or disease management. If he wanted to take, you know, Huberman and I and pit us against each other with respect to like exercise recommendations, I'm ready to go. Let's do the thing. And maybe that would be entertaining for folks, but again, from an epistemic standpoint, you have to agree on like how you're going to evaluate the question and the premise. And so I don't think that there is epistemic consistency on that particular show, but we can hope maybe one day.
Would you be open to having those conversations or those debates on your own podcast? Like bringing someone on and...
Yeah, my fear is I don't want to platform somebody that I don't think deserves the platform. So for example, like, why don't we have Squat U on our, I mean, I went to college with Aaron. Aaron, I still consider him a friend. I have no personal beef with Dr. Horshig. Whatever we went to college together. We're always nice to each other and had good times. But as far as where we disagree, yeah, there are multiple areas, right? But I don't want to bring him on our podcast because I'm like, I don't want to give somebody the same level of expertise, like demonstrate that by platforming them on our podcast. Our podcast gets, you know, a couple hundred thousand downloads a month and, you know, wide listenership. And yeah, sure, if he had a podcast, it's probably going to get more listeners. But at the same time, like, I don't want to be like, yeah, we're the same. His expertise is the same as my expertise. And so this is just us talking. And it's not because I view myself as superior or whatever. It's just like, look, man, I know the information you put out and I know what the evidence says. And it's like, I do not think that I can really do more good than potential harm here by platforming you. That was the same thing with Kevin Bass. Kevin Bass was like, doing deadlifts are uniquely injurious. And we're like, people were like, put him on your podcast. I'm like, why? He doesn't know anything about anything. Like, I'm not going to platform him. But you know, if somebody else was hosting the debate, let's go. It's just, I view our websites material, our podcast material, our YouTube material is sort of like a sacred, it's like a sacred cow. Like I don't want to dilute it. I don't want to, you know, create a bunch of confusion. And so I just want to protect that. And maybe that's not great from a business perspective, but you know, we didn't cover that in the NBA. That wasn't there. Like, should you generate controversy to generate clicks and likes and dollars or whatever? I don't know. So.
Yeah. And you've been mentioning this a little bit now, that epistemic, like root, the base. And I think some people that I try to have conversations with about, I don't know, low back pain is a great topic, you know, and maybe I'll reference Derek Miles for something. And, you know, someone may get into some kind of a debate scenario. And I'm like, man, in my head, I'm thinking Derek Miles would bury you.
Yeah, exactly. And
mental gymnastics and circles around you for days because of how intelligent and how much that man has read. However, if you talk about how much that man has read in the literature, then people say, well, I don't really care about the research. You know, the research is behind it. And it's like, well, why are we even having this discussion?
Exactly. And, yeah.
And now you got to go soon. Maybe what would you say, you know, is your epistemic base of what you use, and maybe one little quick plug for why use that versus. Sure.
Yeah. My main thing, if I'm trying to answer a question or evaluate a problem and turn to the literature, I want to look at human outcomes from specific interventions. So we did X. Here's what happened in our intervention group. Here's what happened in the placebo group. And that would be like the gold standard. And again, human outcomes. I don't really care what happens in mice. I don't really care what happens in macaque monkeys or seahorses or whatever. I don't really care what happens in a petri dish. All of those things are useful for generating hypotheses to test in humans to the extent you can. And so that's like my grade A level. Like, okay, I feel pretty confident about that, particularly if the intervention group is similar to the group of folks that I'm talking to. So that's like ecological validity, subject-based validity, et cetera. If that doesn't exist, then I'm like, all right, are there case control studies, again, in humans, showing that people who did this on average had this outcome? And I feel less confident in that because I don't really know, all right, if we had a group of people do this intervention, would they get better? That's not really what's been evaluated in the study, but I feel more confident than if there is no data at all or just mechanistic data. Mechanistic data, again, is interesting to me overall. Just from a science standpoint, I feel like Sherlock Holmes, I'm like, ooh, cool. But like, if there's no human data showing a difference, I'm like, I don't really know how this changes how I think about things, if it does at all. So if you're trying to answer a question, evaluate a premise, look for human data first. Usually for most common conditions or issues, there's clinical practice guidelines, excellent place to start. From there, pull the research, the primary literature from the clinical practice guidelines, and you can go down a rabbit hole. Otherwise, I think, you know, if you do not have extensive experience reading the literature, I think from a time like economic standpoint, maybe you just go to experts. Because if you charged everyone with, you have to learn how to read scientific literature, I don't think that's possible without formal training, right? Guided, formalized training. And so people are like, how do I get better at reading the literature? I'm like, cool, what's your background? They're like, oh, I was a communications major and now I work in sales or whatever. It's like, I don't think that's necessarily something that's worth your time to do. Let's just look at what on average do the experts agree on, where are their areas of uncertainty, and then you can sort of make decisions from there. But if you really want to go into the science hard, look for clinical practice guidelines, pull the primary literature from there, look at the data on human outcomes, and then evaluate how you know, how solid that evidence is based on size of the treatment group, the durability of the effect, how long did it last, and the difference in effect. If it's a big change, you can feel more confident than if it's a small change, which could be due to chance. And obviously there are other issues in literature, you know, p-hacking and whatnot, but yeah, that's how I start things. If I have a question, I'm looking for human data. And if there's no human data, I'm kind of like, all right, maybe we'll table this till there is.
Wrapping things up, Jordan, where do you see barbell medicine going in the next 3-5+ years? What are the big goals?
I think we're out of the supplement game completely, because that is a block for us to get into the medical continuing ed space, just conflict of interest thing. So we're out of that. We're offering medical continuing ed, Obviously continuing ed for PTs strength coaches. We'll have certificate programs. And a lot of that stuff will be available through like distance learning. Cause I think that's probably our next focus. That's probably the biggest change. We'll still be putting out articles, videos and podcasts, but I think the biggest transition is going to be into the online ed space. Yeah, if we can do that, I think we'll be in a good place here in a few years.
Hell yeah. Well, thanks for coming on, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Yeah, I'll come back with the better octopodi fun facts next time.
Nailed it. Solid. Sounds great.